This podcast is a member of the Association of Poetry Podcasting
at poetrypodcasting.org.
Hello and welcome to UK Poetry Podcast episode 80, the show with interviews, behind the scenes, hints and tips and reviews of poetry performances with me, your host Dominic O'Rourke, and we've got a great interview lined up for you today. If you've tuned in and had a listen to episode 79, you'll have heard the poetry of David Francis, singer-songwriter from Texas via New York, and has been releasing poetry about England as well, and also songwriting stuff as well. I know David's got a new album out at the moment, but we sat down and had a chat at the Royal Festival Hall last year when he was doing his tour over here, and it was really good and really interesting to sit down and talk about the differences between poetry and songwriting. But that's enough about me blathering on. Let me hand you over to David Francis himself. Thank you. Yeah. David Francis, welcome to UK Poetry Podcast. I ask all my guests to introduce themselves. How do you introduce yourself?
Well, right now I'm on a tour of England, I'm happy to say, and this is the second date of the tour. The first one was last night in Milton Keynes, and doing about 14 gigs. Some of them are readings, some of them are playing songs, and last year I put out a poetry album called Poems, which is poems with pieces of instrumental music in between, and this year has been very good because I've been publishing some old and some new poems in some UK magazines and some US magazines, so I'm pretty happy about that and gratified. And that's the main thing right now.
You're not just a poet. Is there a ranking? You know, is it poet, songwriter, songwriter, poet? Feel more affinity for one or the other?
Not really. The problem is more in the perception of people looking at you rather than oneself. I mean, it's sort of like I was known more as a singer-songwriter, especially in New York. And I had always written poetry and read poetry, but I'd sort of concentrated more on songs and everything. So when I started publishing poetry again after several years and put out a poetry album, some people were maybe confused about that because the audience for songs and poetry, unfortunately to me, who like both of them equally, is sort of a different audience. So it's kind of like some people don't know what to think about you if you're putting out song albums and then you put out a poetry album, or vice versa.
Yeah.
But since I love both poetry and music the same, and I sort of struggled with that for years, and I thought, well, you got to like one more and all that, but I just can't do it. And every day I think, which one do I like more? And I like them both the same. So I feel like it's sort of my mission in life to bring poetry to the music people and vice versa. So I don't really have a choice because that's what I'm doing.
So can I ask you how you got started with poetry? What's your earliest memories?
I think it was that, if you really want to go back early, so my mother taught me to read before I started school, which was really nice and a great influence on me. So I was able to read books like Charles Gardner versus Robert Louis Stevenson, and sort of Victorian anthologies of poetry. And I think it was those first English poems, those rhythms and the iambic pentameter and all that really got under my skin. So I started writing little verses when I was maybe 9 or something. And they were kind of derivative verses. And that was my first feeling of poetry, was just that formal.
So you got a lot of support then, sort of?
Well, when I was a little kid, I wrote a poem, and My mother sent it off to the Reader's Digest, and both of us not knowing anything about poetry markets, and of course they sent us a rejection letter which said, well, the Reader's Digest doesn't take poetry. But that was a nice thing for my mother to be supportive of me. Anyway, that was the beginning of my career. But that wasn't the last of my rejection slips by any means. I have several sheaths of them.
Where's your mother still sending you stuff after asking?
Yeah, in fact, I have to put a check in the mail today. I wish you hadn't brought that up. That's kind of embarrassing at my age. But anyway. Maybe you can edit this.
So what about performing poetry? How did you start standing up and doing stuff?
Well, I really started more in music. You know, I was in garage bands, and I had a lot of experience performing in music. And then when I was a bit older, I knew some people that had a really was a dance performance group, and they had never had a poet read, and so they let me read with them, and that was the first time I had read in a sort of a structured environment with an audience. So that audience was really a dance, sort of avant-garde dance audience, and they weren't necessarily amenable to hearing poetry, so it was kind of a daunting experience. But I got up and read, and there was a complete, utter silence after I read, and I thought, well, that was a disaster, you know. But then there was this applause. Applause started up, and it seemed like they really liked it. So that was actually maybe beginner's luck, but that was a very good experience. And that was, I think, the first time that I had read after a long time.
Do you write for an audience then, or is it?
No, but the thing is, when you play music on stage, like in New York, I've had residencies in bars and cafes, so you learn a lot about the kind of things that go over on stage. So if you have an hour set or 2 hour set, and you do learn a lot about how to pace yourself. So this influences you, and after that experience, when I write a poem, I think I'm a little more objective about reading it as if I were an audience member, and thinking about things like repetitions or reiterations that might be dull or lulling in a bad way. So I think it helps me. It's not that I write for an audience. I don't think that's a good idea at all. I think you should write what you feel and what turns you on. But then when you edit it, think about reading it, it helps to think, is this boring? Just as if you were watching someone else. So in that sense, yes.
So do you find it easy to edit your own work then? Is that,
Not really, but I mean, ideally, it's sort of like the Greeks, I don't remember the quote, is that you should let it sit for 7 years or something like that. I mean, that's a really good advice. I mean, it's not, people might not want to do that when they're really ambitious about getting something published, but it is nice if you have an old poem and you look at it again. If you look at it after years and it still moves you, it means something's there. So that's it's sort of time. The time element is very important. It's hard to edit one's own stuff. But I think you read it to yourself and read it to a friend or someone you respect, maybe a friend who's a writer. And you can tell whether it goes over or not. And if it doesn't go over, I think you have to look at it again, give it a long, hard look. But I don't enjoy editing. I think I'm much happier when I'm intensely doing the editing while I'm writing, because I don't really want to go back.
So is that part of your writing process then? You know, what,
yes.
Do you do a lot of your composition in your in your head, so to speak, before it even gets onto the page.
Yeah, and I think you do that even more when you have more experience. You learn that you don't sit and stare at a piece of paper and write one line. I mean, that can be... I mean, there are no rules to this. Everyone does it his own way, his or her own way, but sometimes it's best to write almost the entire poem in your head. Or, for example, writing a sonnet, it's definitely smart to write like the octave part if it's a Petrarchan sonnet or something, and then when you get down to the argument or the final lines, you've already got your argument and you can concentrate on that, perhaps. You know? So, yeah, memory and being able to... Because if the idea is not intense enough, for example, for you to do that, it probably means that it's not that interesting. If it doesn't grip you enough to concentrate that hard, then why is someone else going to... Why do you think someone else is going to benefit from this?
So the content then, I mean, from what I've heard of your poetry, it seems quite biographical. It's, is it drawn from experience? Or... Or common themes. I mean, I'm thinking particularly the poem we talked about Times Square, how hard it is to go back to places. I mean, it sounds generally something that's drawn from experience.
Well, it's definitely from experience and pain and pleasure and nostalgia and all these different emotions. The thing is, you have to find some kind of symbol that's universal so that other people don't feel that it's subjective, that it's your experience. It becomes somehow everyone's experience. If it doesn't get to that level, then I don't really think it's successful.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of those poems stay in the notebook, so to speak. I have a lot of poems like that that I feel really are too subjective. And there are degrees of that, of what's acceptable, an acceptable level of subjectivity, perhaps. But I think in the case of the songwriter poem, I think the reason that poem was published probably is because the editor figured that it had become universal. But the impetus and the emotional sort of drive that made me write it was very personal and was from my own feelings of displacement and anger and resentment and all those emotions that one has about finding oneself in a new world, perhaps, or finding certain elements of one's experience to be vanished without any explanation. So I think a lot of poetry comes out of that.
I think one of your other pieces from the CD poems about London, which I grabbed on about a 40p bus ride to Shepherd's Bush.
That was dated
so
for sure,
ago.
Right? Oh, yeah. No question. Yeah, I didn't alter that. That was obviously very old, but I left it. I made a decision not to change any of those poems.
So this has not been the first time you've been to London. I mean, that album from 2006 is about London.
Yeah, it's from a long time ago. It's I lived here for a year. I lived in London for a year, and I wrote a lot of songs and poetry that had a lot of meaning to me. And some of the songs I still play, and all that poetry was actually written back then in London and Paris. And it was never published. And I was going to make a new album of songs, and I had everything ready. And then I revisited London 2 years ago, and I had this great emotional experience, and I just thought, kind of almost a grief about these poems that had never been published.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tolerate it, you know, so I thought, why don't I do an album of poems? And I always had an idea of, I listened to a lot of poetry albums, and some of which I thought were kind of boring the way they were done, and I thought, I wanted to make a poetry album that was a little different.
Yeah.
So that's what I was really trying to do. And I already had the text, so to speak.
Because the album, regardless of content, is very well engineered. You know, the structure of it, it's, I mean, most poetry albums, CDs, is just kind of someone recording at a venue, and it's...
Right.
But there's a lot of studio work put into it as well. And I presume that comes from your songwriting experience of working in a studio.
Well, yeah, that really... It's not really songwriting as much as you said, there's just actual logging of hours in the studio, because I had made a couple of hours, and I had worked with a very good engineer. I'll give him a plug. His name is Jeff Phillips. I mean, he's with a lot of experience, has made vinyl records back in the day, and really knew how to. So yeah, I mean, I wanted to make a poetry record that was excellent in audio terms and was excellently arranged musically and produced, and was something that could be played over and over. For example, if you make a poetry record like Sitting Here, if you're a very good poet, you can read your poem. That's the whole point. They stand alone. But the quality of the actual recording could make it difficult to listen to over and over again, in a sense. So I wanted to make something that was also entertaining in that sense. Be a work of art, and also there would be little points, fine points that the listener could hear on repeated listenings, you know.
And the musical pieces in between each of the tracks, then, do they, they don't just complement the writing, the poetry, they seem to be extensions of the poems?
Yeah, that was the challenge on the record was to, I mean, one thing I didn't want was for the poem and the musical interlude to sort of cancel each other out, which was possible. So what I did was I used bits of melodies that I had written at the same time that I wrote the poems, and then I composed other pieces after contemplating, kind of meditating on the poems. And I spent a lot of time on that and editing them down and shuffling them around. And I really especially didn't want the music to overwhelm the text. So I hope I was successful at that.
I'm touching on it, but it seems a good point to bring it in, and to talk about, you know, lyrics and poetry, and you know, what difference do you see between the two? I know you've just written an essay on it.
It's true, I've written an essay on it, and I still don't really know.
Next question.
Kind of like no, we have to stay on it. I always started it. It's kind of like that, the old Supreme Court ruling on pornography, when the judge says, "I know it when I see it."
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way I feel about it. But I mean, what I did, like, I gave a speech on that last night at a writer's club. The thing was, I played a song and then I read a poem, which is easier than to sort of pontificate about it.
Yeah.
I played a song that was written as a poem, but I knew it wasn't a poem, and it stayed in the notebook, and then years later I wrote a melody to it, and I said something about it. But then I asked the people there, the audience, I said, you know, to engage them, I said, why do you think that this is a song rather than a poem? That sort of started the discussion. I think to some extent modern poetry, the tradition of modernist, say British American poetry, has been kind of the idea that we can use sort of folk or stanzaic type of forms, but we use them somewhat ironically, whereas in a poem you don't necessarily, in a song you don't necessarily do that. For example, the song that I played was in kind of quatrains, like eight of those, with a sort of a refrain, kind of like an old border ballad or something like that. But it was kind of straight ahead. Even it has slight symbolist influence, kind of French symbolist influence, if you want to be precise about it. But I felt that that worked as a poem when you put a good melody to it. I mean, excuse me, as a song when you put a good melody to it.
Yeah, there is
a difference between yeah, I know, this would be lying my whole premise here, right? Subconsciously. And we had a big discussion about this last time. It was really interesting because we finally came up to the idea that people sort of feel like songs are more directly somehow from the heart, and the poems are more kind of observational. But we could all give a lot of examples of where this isn't really true.
I read something just recently, which I actually read a long time ago, that every single Emily Dickinson poem can be sung along to the tune of Yellow Rose of Texas, and that the whole rhythm within her poetry was so influenced by music or listening to music that it may not be as complicated as we would like to believe her to be.
Well,
is that oversimplifying? Feel like where lyrics and poetry come into play? Is there too much in the rhythm of lyrics?
The problem with talking about Emily Dickinson is that she was really a genius.
Yeah.
And she was she's not even my favorite poet, but I really pay homage to her. I kneel to her because I really think that this was a person, an American genius, who was not recognized and everything, but she can sort of get away with anything she wants because her mind was so metaphysical. And she used slant rhymes and things like that that people weren't really doing much. There's no record that she was influenced by contemporary poets. She lived a very sheltered life, everybody knows. I think that's just, her mind was so radical and original that I think what makes her great is just the fact that the way that she contemplated the universe and God and nature and, you know, so she sort of got away with this kind of, I think these poems I've read that they were sort of from the rhythm of hymns from the church. But I get your point, is that there's this kind of like a I'm trying to think of the word. What would be monotonous? I mean, no modern poet would do that and say, I'm going to take one form and just write everything according to that form. She got away with that. But I think that can only be explained by genius. I really do. So I think you might have to use a different example in the sense that she's the exception to the rule. But well, in the past, obviously, poets did write to music, and music was, poetry was, I think in the long ago past, that music and dance and poetry were the same thing.
Yeah.
And they've become separated, especially in our period, or maybe in the, 19th century, from then on. This idea, when the poet became more alienated, and the modernist poet, same as the painters, and the poets started writing more for other poets rather than the general public, perhaps. Then you have a problem of a schism of where you have popular music and unpopular poetry, and we're talking about techniques that they use in common. But the techniques are influenced by the expectations of the audience as well. For example, in a pop song, I mean, it's understood in pop music that a lot of people claim not to listen to the lyrics, or the pop music is used to dance, or whatever it's used for, or wallpaper, or background, or whatever, a kind of muzak. Well, you really, it's absurd to think of poetry being used that way. You can't use it. I think Auden said something like that, right? That the thing about it is, with poetry, one person has to sit and read it. And that changes the technique, because in song lyrics, you can use inexact rhyme, and you can vary the syllabic feet and all these things, and really no one cares, except maybe some critic. In poetry, a lot of the appreciation and talk about poetry has to do with, did this poet follow the rules? Did he use irony in a way that we approve of in this period we're living in, and different things like this? It's more...
Is that because poetry is just populated with critics?
I think it's an unfortunate thing. No one knows what to do about it. But it's sort of gotten to where... I went to a reading the other night. I'm sure other people have the same experience. And one of the readers came up to me and said, are you a writer? And I said, yes, but tonight... And she said, aren't you going to read something? And because it was a sort of an open mic, and then they had a couple of featured poets. And I said, no, tonight I'm being a member of the audience. And she seemed to get upset. So the idea was, it was almost a vanity affair, where we're only there so we can read. There's no audience.
It kind of brings me on to my sort of my last question, my wrap up thing. So, what advice do you have for poets? And for songwriters?
I think it takes a lifetime to write a few good poems. So I think that if you don't really want to do it above everything else, like if you don't feel like you have to do it, then don't bother with it, because it's very arduous. And it's also very rewarding. But I mean, I think one has to read a lot. One has to be very critical, self-critical, which is not pleasant. But it's... One has to learn that. One has to be one's own editor. And the thing is that but there are some things that you have to live. I remember when I was younger, I would write. And it's the same thing with song lyrics. Sometimes you're writing about something and you feel somehow that... You don't really have authority about what you're speaking. So when a person speaks, this is true in life as well, not just in literature. This is like when one is speaking words that one can stand behind, then one has a feeling of authority and well-being. And it's the same with writing a poem. And the poems that I feel that are more successful that I've done. And I don't mean successful in terms of, you know, even being published or that, but more like that I'm proud of, are ones that I think, well, I took some part of experience in my life that I really paid my dues for, and found the right words and the right sort of meter or form and put it into. So it's a combination of craft and intense feeling and the desire to capture something out of fleeting life.
Dave Francis, thank you so much for this interview. Wish you best of luck with your CD and the songwriting and the performances and everything you do. Thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thanks a lot, Dominic. Appreciate it.
Okay, a big thank you to David Francis. As always, if you show your appreciation by purchasing his CDs, they're all available from CD Baby. The exact web address will be in the show notes. Have a look at that there. It's always much appreciated, as much as I appreciate you, the listener, for tuning in and listening to UK Poetry Podcast. Make sure you join us again for the next show, and we'll have more poetry and a lot more of the same sort of stuff that's going on these shows. So remember, all works included in this show are protected by national and international copyright laws. They may only be downloaded and played for your own personal use. Any form of reproduction, read, performance or distribution is only permitted with the express consent of the copyright holders.
This-
This podcast is a member of the Association of Poetry Podcasting
at poetrypodcasting.org.